I'm Martin Galfadovic from Smithsonian Institution Libraries, and with me is my colleague Alvin Hutchinson. And we're going to talk to you a little bit about our project to do Spanish language e-publications. So the first thing I want to ask is how many people are familiar with the Smithsonian? Good, most people, good. How many people knew there was a library associated with the Smithsonian? A couple people, good. So what I want to do is show you just a quick little video that we've done for that.
What you can discover behind these doors.
I'll start once more.
What you can discover behind these doors might surprise you. The keys to your history and your heritage, your culture, and your future are all closer than you think. From 13th century manuscripts to electronic journals, in subjects ranging from art to zoology, our nearly 2 million collected volumes make us the world's largest museum library system. And our doors are open to you. We are librarians and researchers dedicated to helping us all understand the forces of nature and culture that continue to shape our world. We are conservators committed to preserving and digitizing an aging legacy, allowing us to share more than 50,000 rare books and manuscripts that are found almost nowhere else. Supported by limited funding from the federal government and partnerships with citizens like you, our mission is to advance an understanding of science, technology, the arts, and the American experience. Each year, tens of thousands of visitors come to Washington, D.C., New York City, and Panama to access the libraries in person. Today, you have the opportunity to explore our collections virtually by clicking any of the doors on your screen. Learn how you can help protect a centuries-old heritage by partnering with the Smithsonian Libraries. With your support, we can continue a rich tradition of discovery and preservation. Let the Smithsonian Libraries surprise you.
So this is our little promotional video so that we don't have to say exactly who we are all the time. So this is not yet publicly available. So if anyone has any feedback or comments on that, feel free to let us know as we sort of continue to work on that process. But again, we are the world's largest museum library, and as such, we have a whole lot of information within our collections related to the various collections of the Smithsonian. So everyone indicated that they were familiar with the Smithsonian, but I want to sort of give you a little graphic and some little facts about the Smithsonian, which will help sort of set the context for the rest of the project. So here's some of our Smithsonian staff. These are the Washington group that gathered in 2010 to do this one of these group portraits that sort of trace out the Smithsonian sunburst. And whoops, go back. So here are some of the quick facts about the Smithsonian. We now have 19 museums, and those are, again, located all around the Washington area as well as in New York City. We have research centers based in Washington, again, but also the Republic of Panama, Cambridge, Massachusetts, Arizona, and various other places in our research areas. We also maintain and run the National Zoological Park in Washington and an environmental research center out in Fort Royal, Virginia, which is about 100 miles from Washington, D.C. We have about 137 million artifacts, specimens, and artworks in the collections. 7.4 million of those objects have digital records online through our digital collections search project, which is a way where you can actually access the metadata on all of those collections, as well as about 500,000 digital manifestations of those through that particular interface. And you can get to a lot more of the stuff through all the different other silos of information we have. The library is about 1.9 million volumes, and we have about 122,000 cubic feet of archival space. So it's a big heterogeneous collection of materials that we have. The library, again, is sort of in the center of this, and when we posed for this picture, the librarians all stood in the middle and wore red shirts so that we would stand out from the rest of the group. So that's us in there, and Alvin's the tall person over on the right. So again, we have all kinds of traditional library services and rooms. We have many different reading rooms in those 20 different libraries that we have located between Panama and New York City and Cambridge, Massachusetts. This is our Cooper Hewitt National Design Museum in New York City, which just closed for renovation, and the library just reopened. So this room doesn't look like this anymore, but it's a brand new facility in the old Andrew Carnegie Mansion. So the Smithsonian has all of this information, all of these artifacts, specimens, and collections, and a lot of people are very focused on those in the Washington, D.C. context. But we also have a wide, world-ranging audience, and a lot of those are non-English speakers. So when we think about our Smithsonian information, we're also thinking about it in Spanish language. This is in our facility in Panama, which is one of our more publicly accessible facilities, and it's jointly run with the University of Panama. So we get large numbers of Panamanian students to come into this research library there. So again, it's a very Spanish-focused collection there in terms of the services. So when we were thinking about the book collections and as we were doing digital projects, we thought as we were making e-books of our other types of collections, which Alvin will tell you a little bit more about, we thought we'd try and think about what we could do in terms of Spanish language e-publications. And what really made me think about this was there was a lot of press starting in about 2010 in terms of the Hispanic community, in terms of their use of e-readers, their need for more materials on those, and how they were being served in various types of commercial outlets in terms of e-publications. And the one that really struck me was the Pew Internet and the American Life Project report, which showed that Hispanic adults were actually the most likely demographic to own e-readers, and as almost double some of the other demographic groups. And this sort of set me off to thinking, like, what kinds of stuff can we do to sort of provide content for all of these e-readers that are out there in the hands of Spanish-speaking, Spanish-reading users? And these are just some more of those facts about the heavy use of tablets amongst the Hispanic community. And again, in 2010, Barnes & Noble had a commercial bookstore for Spanish-language e-pubs. And then our Smithsonian Latino Center has an internal grant structure. And what they do is they'll make annual grants to the other Smithsonian units to do projects that promote the Spanish language collections within the Smithsonian. So we got to thinking, and what we decided to do is what could we do to make public domain materials, open access materials available through EPUBs in partnership with the Latino Center. The Latino Center is a very large Second Life project where they have a virtual Latino museum within Second Life. So one of our ideas was how could we integrate some of these e-publications into a Spanish language library within Second Life. We haven't got too far with the whole Second Life thing since I think Second Life is sort of on a descending trajectory, so we haven't really focused on that aspect of it. But the idea of sort of working with the Latino Center to bring more Spanish language texts out was what sort of continued to grow with this project. So stepping back a bit, we are thinking again about the generation of texts. So again, when you have physical books, you go back to the original Codex with Gutenberg, and you had about 125 titles published a year for that first almost 200 years of publication of print books. So we had a very good history of that in terms of how you use them. You didn't, generally speaking, need an owner's manual in terms of how to figure out how to use a book anymore. That's all been sort of 500 years of experience. And the books continue to get being made. So from those originally 125 a year that were going out through the printing process in those first years, there's now about 270,000 titles coming out. And when you look at the sort of where they're coming from, again, the U.S. and U.K. are the leading publishers of books, and the Spanish-speaking community countries are much further down on this list. So again, this was another impetus for us to see what we could do from the historical legacy of Spanish language publications to make those available as full-fledged e-books. You probably all remember this Google number that came out a few months ago about there being approximately 130 million books ever printed in the history of printing. Of those 130 million, about 10 million are available in some form of an e-publication, whether it's a Project Gutenberg full-text conversion or just a PDF of something. So again, how could we add more Spanish-speaking text to this body of literature? And again, it's important for the libraries to think about this because when you consider the EPUBs, they take up a lot less space. So here's a typical third-generation Kindle, where you can fit 3,500 of them onto one Kindle that doesn't take up much space on your shelves. Again, just some other facts that were sort of moving us forward in this project. These are those Amazon statistics that came out as they were selling more EPUBs versus hardcovers. And then they came out with a further statistic a few months after that where they were actually selling a higher percentage of paper of EPUBs than their actual paperback. So again, more impetus to create Spanish language text there. Another interesting thing that I came across was some sales figures from Smashwords. And so I generated this chart to show sort of what that those sales numbers were telling us. Because oftentimes when you think about technology and e-publications, you think of it as sort of a bi-coastal kind of thing and a high-income demographic, the kinds of things where it's sort of it's a one more of a 1% or type of actual product. When you look at the sales of Smashwords, it's actually the exact flip of that. It's really more of a rural and less developed portions of the country are the real big purchasers of e-books. So actually, Alaska has the highest per capita sales of e-books from Smashwords than anywhere else, and California is amongst the lowest in terms of actual per capita sales. And again, it sort of breaks down into sort of a lot of the rural places, Utah, Colorado, North Dakota, again, high sales of EPUBs. So again, what we were thinking here is we don't have a lot of Spanish-speaking speakers in those demographic areas that have high ebook sales, and maybe one of the reasons that they're not in higher places like in Texas and California, Arizona, New Mexico is because there's not enough content there for the Spanish-speaking community. So again, civilization marches on, and part of it becomes a sort of a content for e-publications. We also just wanted to make sure that we're totally agnostic on the type of reader that we promote for these things. We're really promoting the publication itself and the format. So again, we try to make all of our publications work on all the different flavors of e-readers, so Nooks, Sony, Kobo, Kindle, iPad, whatever your reader is, we'll deliver it in the appropriate mechanism. So to that effect, we do both the EPUB and the Mobi format so that everyone can have accessibility to those. I'm Diane Gannett's background. I am a librarian. I have a cat. I have a Kindle, and I read Jane Austen, so I fit into that demographic of librarian. And the other thing I want to point out again is when we're talking about this, we're not talking about the death of print. So again, I brought in my daughter's copy of Pat the Bunny to prove that she chews on it, which she doesn't do on her e-books. So again, we're not here to kill print books with this type of project. We're here to supplement print books with other types of formats. And sticking with the bunny theme, one of the books we did convert was this 1916 publication from Spain that's a children's book about rabbits. So just in case children do want to read about rabbits in Spanish, they can read this particular book. So again, part of our library mission is so that you can not only charge books out, like Pat the Bunny, but you can actually charge up your Kindles or your Sony e-readers or your Nooks in the library electronically and then fill them with our materials. There are a number of issues that we are concerned about and that sort of cause problems when we try to do these types of projects. The first is copyright, working with other partners, and then engaging with other initiatives such as the DPLA and multi-platform, multi-format. So just to go quickly through those, I'm sure everyone's aware of all the restrictions that copyright has gone through for the past 20 years or so as the copyrights have sort of changed. This has really put a very strict confines on what we can do with conversions of a lot of materials. So this is one of our real big problems when we're thinking about doing conversion of our cultural heritage materials is the strict copyright rules that we're living under now, so which is very complicated. The other is, again, it's working with partners like the Internet Archive is very important for us because they do, again, provide us with a very good open platform so that we can provide very quick and easy delivery through that mechanism if we want. They're also our digitization partners, so we work with them to scan. The Smithsonian's done over 4 to 5 million pages of digital conversion with the Internet Archive. And the key thing here is the work that they've done on a book delivery system, and this was highlighted at the Books and Browsers meeting in 2010, where, again, the goal was to deliver books on not specific devices, not specific apps, not specific browsers, but across all three of those different mechanisms. And then most recently, I've become involved with the Digital Public Library of America. I'm the co-chair of the technical work stream. And how many people are familiar with the Digital Public Library of America, or DPLA? DPLA is a grant-funded initiative that is aiming to create a platform for delivery of a digital public library of America. And many people ask, what exactly would that be? And the answer is, we don't know exactly yet. It's going to be a community-developed process. But part of the things we want to do is create a platform where we can deliver e-publications, where we can deliver in-copyright materials through agreements with publishers and other types of arrangements, and most importantly, work very closely with local libraries throughout the country to integrate this platform with their services. So it's not a competitor to your local library, but actually a partner to help you deliver services at your local level that can be best done through leveraging content at a larger level. So again, we want to integrate our Spanish language EPUBs as closely as possible into this DPLA project. For those of you who aren't following it, there'll be another plenary session meeting, which will be widely broadcast in April, that'll be coming out of San Francisco. So again, when we started our EPUB publication project, which Alvin will tell you the details about, we delivered them through this very sexy interface that you see here, which is a DSpace environment. So again, this is the kind of thing that really makes people want to go out and read, I'm sure. But at the same time, we're also moving them to other platforms. So we do have an arrangement with iTunes University to deliver, again, free content through the Apple platform. The first product that we are delivering through that is actually another project, which is a science project called the Biodiversity Heritage Library Project, which has topics such as Charles Darwin's personal library, which we have digitized with some of our partners in the UK. And you can download items from Darwin's personal library through iTunes. We've done some other Smithsonian publications, and the Spanish ones will be there shortly. We're also working with Open Library, which is the sort of more public face to the Internet Archive, so that these EPUBs can go back into the Internet Archive and then be delivered through this more user-friendly Open Library interface. And we've also had discussions with OverDrive. How many people are familiar with OverDrive? So those of you who aren't, basically it's a middleware between publishers and libraries, and enables you to lend books through e-books through a library system, with a lot of caveats and a lot of recent concerns with the publishers on that. And again, we do want to make them available through the Nook bookstore. Again, since these are free, our goal here is to actually leverage the different types of bookstores. So by giving these people free content, they can then sell other types of content around that too. So making as much stuff available as free as possible to give additional collections. Similarly with Amazon. Amazon now has a Spanish language bookstore. So again, this content will eventually flow into the Amazon bookstore as free content. So thank you. That's my portion of it. And now Alvin's going to talk a little bit about the more details of the project and some of our other scholarly communications things that revolve around that type of e-publication. Alvin?
Okay, thanks. This one on? Okay. I'm Alvin Hutchinson. I'm a librarian also, and I'm here to talk sort of about nuts and bolts, technological and logistical issues we dealt with in the Latino EPUBs conversion. But first, I want to sort of build a little bit on what Martin was saying about libraries and e-books and the relationship and things like that. Anybody here a librarian? Couple, right? So what I get a lot from people is, why are librarians doing this? I mean, this is a publishing thing, right? Why is a librarian converting these things to books to digital form? So a little background is, I think one of the things that's happened in libraries, and a lot of things in the internet or the digital age, is a lot of services have been pushed to a self-service model. Right? Years ago, 20 years ago or so, you depended on a librarian for a lot more than you do today. I mean, there's a range of services that librarians provided that's shrunk today because there's online, you know, do-it-yourself, get online, you know, libraries license digital content that you can help yourself to, but that at one time you needed a librarian to do for you. It's the same thing with a lot of, you know, government services. I mean, we pay taxes online, renew your motor vehicle registration, retails all over, you buy things online. You don't need to visit a store or to call, you know, a customer service experience anymore. You do need that in part, but less and less. So what you see in libraries more and more these days is people with laptops and mobile devices, who just help themselves to the content. They don't need a librarian as much as they once did. In fact, you don't even need to go to the library in many cases, or go there during open, you know, their hours or anything like that. So this is, like I say, librarians, I think libraries are sort of an acute example of the self-service model that's emerging with the network technology, I guess. So what that has led to recently, in recent years, is a lot of speculation in media and other places about whether we need libraries or whether we need librarians. You know, people think, well, it's all online now, isn't it? Google does all that, and I can find anything I want now. I don't need a librarian. I would hope that everybody in this room, certainly us two, believe that librarians and libraries are still needed in some ways, but that we're going to have to sort of change our business model. We used to, you know, for years and years, libraries collected books, put them on shelves in a building, and waited for people to walk in and express a research need, and the librarian would sort of lead you to the book or books that you that might be relevant to you, et cetera, et cetera. But unfortunately, I think the people who make decisions about budgets and you know, administrative types, university presidents and others who, you know, basically write the checks, are looking at stories like this and thinking, yeah, that's right, what about libraries? Why do we need this? Do we need as many libraries or as many librarians? And would think about reducing the budgetary footprint. So in response, I think a lot of librarians, or I would say forward-looking librarians, have begun to offer different services, aside from or in addition to the traditional collection of building print collections and serving people who need to use them. And I won't go into the range of services that librarians can start providing, but among them is relates to what we're doing here. So one of the things that you see a lot in research libraries and university libraries is a partnership between the libraries and the university press. The Smithsonian has a scholarly press where they, you know, they publish books on, let's be honest, rather esoteric topics, you know, narrowly defined subjects that aren't, you know, not going to be sold, make the New York Times bestseller list or anything like that, but that are nonetheless distributed to scholars around the world. You know, they may not publish or they may not sell more than a couple hundred, 300 at the most of some of these titles. And so a lot of university presses are heavily subsidized by the university. I won't say they're losing money, but you know they don't make money, and they don't even break even. Most of them, some of them do, but most of them depend on the university for a subsidy to keep them alive and going. So it's sort of a natural partnership that the libraries, who are sort of under pressure to sort of produce or make themselves relevant or continue to be relevant, should partner with the scholarly press, who are sort of under pressure to produce content that's still desirable. And so like most publishers, newspapers and magazines and everybody has had to develop an online presence in the last 12 or 15 or 20 years, something like that. And most publishers have been accustomed to producing print, right? University presses produce books that are in print. They send it off to be typeset into a binder and a printer, and they get back boxes of books that they have in a warehouse and that they sell and ship to people who buy them. And then, 12, 15 years ago, the internet came around, and it basically, you know, the news was, hey, you've got to be online now, like everybody else. And so it's sort of like a second job. You know, you can't give up your print workflow, but you had to, a lot of publishers had to buy servers and hire web developers and metadata people. And so it's sort of like a, you know, what they call in government, an unfunded mandate, you know, you got to do this, and we're not going to give you any more money for it. That's where libraries were able to step in, do a lot of conversion of their legacy print content. The Smithsonian did that with the scholarly press, metadata services, even something simple like managing their website, you know. So so you see a lot of this at University of Michigan, Cornell, I know, Penn State, Columbia University. Their university presses are sort of, lack of a better term, in bed with the libraries. In fact, in some cases, the university press now reports the library director. I think that's with some universities. So this is like one service or a suite of services that librarians can start offering and to get themselves back on the radar and make themselves, you know, more noticed and noticeable. So that brings us to the digital publishing world. In the past, you know, I suppose most people here know better than this, but if you ask a lot of people about digital publishing, they think PDF, right? It was a neat thing 12, 15 years ago when I first saw it. It was just a rendition of a print on a page. It looks just like the printed book. And it was handy, but it really still needs to be printed in the end. It can be created digitally, it can be transmitted digitally and stored digitally, and that's all fine. But in the end, few people want to read PDF on a screen. You might get a couple paragraphs into it, but either you're going to print it or you're not going to read it at all. That's been my experience. So in the last, I would say, 5 years, or I first heard of e-book when the Kindle came out and other e-readers, say 5-6 years ago, something like that. You started to see the sort of the last mile or the end of the whole digital publishing evolution. That is the thing that you'll read it online. It's comfortable. You don't have to squint, and so you don't have to worry about glare, and you can store it on your digital device and not have to print it. And in fact, I think in many cases you can't print it. And so that sort of, I would hope, completed the whole cycle. A lot of formats emerged. I mean, like with any young technology, there's a lot of players. And in this case, I call it different formats, but it looks like the EPUB and MOBI formats are the two most emerging, the most common. Like Martin said, we don't care what format they're in, but we, in this Latino eBooks conversion project, we concentrated on, or we stuck with the EPUB and MOBI. MOBI is, I guess, is the renderable on a Amazon Kindle, and EPUB is the open format that you can work on a lot of different e-readers. I'll just sort of mention parenthetically that there are a lot of standalone, do-it-yourself, convert your digital content to EPUB. You can, PDF to EPUB or Word or any text to EPUB, and they're pretty handy if you're just converting your own personal collection or one document at a time. But we knew that we were going to do 50 to 100 or more, and we've got plans for a much larger body of work, and we couldn't use something like that. There are a lot of them out there. I haven't used them all. The ones I've seen leave something to be desired with regard to like image formatting, hyperlinking, and some of the bells and whistles that go with ebooks. But I think they'll get there soon. So before we could start converting content, we had to sort of identify a body of literature to work with, and several considerations there. One is copyright, as Martin mentioned. U.S. copyright basically says, there may be some exceptions, but that things published prior to 1923 are in the public domain, or at least fair game for conversion. So we knew we had to concentrate on older, 19th century material and early 20th century things. We wanted to work with things that are not widely held, rare, or scarce, for a lot of reasons. One is that you get more bang for your buck in that way. If you digitize or convert something that's rare, the readership, you're sort of saving someone a trip to the library. If somebody, if the Smithsonian Libraries is the only library in the country that has a book, and we get people all the time who travel to Washington and stay in hotels there and visit our libraries because we're the only one that have this book. But if you convert that to ebook, you're saving somebody a trip. You're sort of reaching a wider audience, it's more helpful. Also, one of the knock-on effects of digitization is, they say, when you create a digital edition of a book, the original, it will be used less, handled less, opened and closed, and taken off the shelf and things like that. And that sort of makes them deteriorate over time. So if you make render a digital edition of a book, it's more likely that the original, the paper, which could be fragile and deteriorating or brittle, will be kept in storage more often or more longer, and so it'll last longer, the theory goes. So we try to concentrate on things that were not widely held. Of course, we didn't want to do something that somebody else had done, and somebody else had created an ebook. We don't avoid that. And then we had to, when we did identify candidate material, we had to sort of scan it for quality. I mean, it had to be good copy to work from. We could have, we worked with digital or print, scan it ourselves, or work from an existing PDF that somebody else had scanned. But it's got to be good, clean, readable, and those are sort of things we had to identify. In the funding we had for this project from the Latino source at Smithsonian, we built into it an intern who would help us with this, identifying the content for conversion. One of the things about this, unusual things, is this intern, we needed a couple of things from the intern. One is some familiarity with the subject, Latin American studies and Spanish language and things like that. And then we wanted a person with a digital skill set who could work on this remotely. It was going to be a virtual internship. Person would not need to come to Washington and work in the Smithsonian on site. They could do the work off site, but they had to be able to search catalogs, create lists, search holdings, and sort of communicate with us virtually, which sounds kind of simple, but we had a lot of applicants, and a number of them, we didn't feel like had that sort of those skills. We ended up with a woman, Cynthia Roscoe, from San Diego, or she had a master's in Latin American Studies from San Diego State University. And at the time, she was getting a second master's in library and information science, I forget where, in California somewhere. And she's now a librarian in Southern California somewhere. And so we hired her for 4 weeks, and it was a paid internship. And we communicated with her regularly once a week. And we were back and forth. She created lists and things for us to look at. And we talked about sources, source material, and wanted to help us to identify the material that we could use for conversion. Her job was creative list, prioritized list, in her opinion, with the best to work with and then on down. So the first thing she did was she searched the Smithsonian Library catalog. And she, I believe, limited her search to things in Spanish and things published prior to 1923, and she found a number of things. We suspected, going into this, that a lot of the things that would be converted would be from the Smithsonian's Department of Anthropology Library, which the Natural History Museum has a strong collection in 19th century and 18th century and even earlier materials. And we had a number of ethnographic studies and people, explorers and scholars in the early 20th and 19th centuries who worked in Latin America and South America. But we also found, she found a number of things from the botany and entomology libraries as well. Again, history of science type things in Spanish. So she took this list of things she found and she checked WorldCat. If anybody's familiar with WorldCat, it's sort of an Uber library catalog. Does a lot of things, but one of the things it does is it tells you basically how many libraries hold a particular title. So you can sort of look for a book there, and it'll tell you which libraries and how many of them in North America generally have this title. And so we tried to concentrate on books that were held by 25 or fewer libraries. We hit that target and much lower. Most of the things we converted were held by far fewer libraries than that. But in addition to our library collection, Cynthia searched the Internet Archive and other online sources, I forget, maybe HathiTrust and things like that, for materials that we could convert. I mean, like I said earlier, we could scan things ourselves and print, but then if there were other already digital surrogates available, we could use those to convert to the EPUB and MOBI formats. So she searched Internet Archive and other things, again, omitting things that are already in the ebook format or that she felt might be ready for conversion. She she was from California. She was in the California University of California system. She knew sort of the operations of the California Digital Library, and she just had some feelings about certain titles that she knew that were going to be converted. So she omitted those or put them farther down in her list of priorities. The things that she identified that were online already, many of them were poor quality. They're PDF, which we could work with, PDF, and then we'd run an OCR, optical character recognition, and strip the text out of them. But they were, many of them were of poor quality like this. Either the images, the original scans were not clean, or the text sort of bled from one page to another. So it was just not something we could work with, as I mentioned. But she identified about 100 titles, ultimately, and our budget only allowed us to work with 48 of them. We identified 48 titles to be converted. And we had to reduce the size or that we limit ourselves to that number, we ended up working with titles that were in the Smithsonian's collection and that we scanned ourselves. They were in paper only, and so we had those scanned ourselves. The Smithsonian Libraries is doing, like many university libraries, is involved in a mass scanning digitization project, and we send a lot of things sort of out to be scanned. There's an industrial scale project going on in the Library of Congress, and we use them for some of this. But we also have an in-house digitization lab where if things are rare or fragile or we don't want them to go out or they're oversized or something like that, we want to do it in-house. So we had them done in-house, these things, and we loaded them up to the Internet Archive. We created a statement of work for a vendor and eventually awarded a contract to somebody to convert these things. But in the statement of work, there were a number of things we had to think about. One of them was that we knew Spanish language title or text would have a lot of diacritics and other things that were not you wouldn't find in English language publications. Also, a lot of it was scientific, so you had to look for mathematical symbols and scientific notation, subscript, superscript, things like that, just to make sure that they knew about that and recognized that. Images, we, of course, from the Internet Archive, the vendor got PDF, got the ASCII, the text, which it would mark up into an XML, you know, format. And then there were, we created from these TIFF, the image files that were available to the vendor. And if there were images to be embedded in the text somewhere, they would use the TIFFs or high resolution image files that we created. If a lot of these things may not have had images in them, these are after all pre they're early works. At the very least, one thing you have to what we had to do was we had a cover image or a thumbnail that most e-readers have on their menu, a list of thumbnails like you see here. Usually it's the cover of the book if it's a popular work, but so we had to make sure that we decided on which image would be the thumbnail, the thing that you opened up with. All e-book formats have hyperlinked, have a lot of bells and whistles, hyperlinks from the table of contents, for example. You can jump down to the chapter 5 instead of scrolling all the way through the text. You can jump around footnotes and endnotes. You see a reference, you click on it, it'll bring you all the way to the reference list. There's a link there that will bring you back to the text that you were reading. So we had to make sure that the vendor knew about that and accommodated that kind of thing. Metadata had to be embedded. That seems kind of simple, but that was a difficult point because it's something you kind of take for granted. Here's the author, here's the title, here's the year, the publisher, and it just had to be formatted correctly and not omitted or not forgotten about it. Just I think vendors are mostly concentrating on getting the text to look right, and metadata is sort of an afterthought for them, but it had to be embedded in there and write the way we sent it to them. And then I don't know, but I've seen some e-books that do not include page numbers, and it makes sense. Some people don't. You're reading an ebook. You don't care what page you're on. They might have a slider bar at the bottom that says you're 10% through or 50% through the book or something like that. And you can bookmark it and come back to it. So why do you need page numbers? Well, in scholarly works, a lot of people, if you want to cite a book, in some disciplines, I'd say, you want to cite not only the book, the publisher, the year, and the author, but you want to include the page number where you found the information you're citing. That's great with a printed book, but an ebook doesn't. Ebook auto can contain the page numbers as well. So we asked the vendor that did the conversion for us to include page numbers there. We knew we were going to have to do a quality review, so we'd send things. The vendor would take this content and convert it to ebook, and then we'd have to look at it when we got it back and make sure it was all done correctly. First thing, of course, is to look at what we're sending them to make sure that's done. I mentioned. That the source material has to be of high enough quality because, you send them garbage, you're going to get garbage back, right? So we made sure that was all done correctly. And then we specified accuracy requirements. I forget exactly, 99.95 or something like that, accuracy requirements. So we did sampling. This was not a terribly large body of text, 48 titles, but eventually it's difficult to sample, look at an entire book, or look at all 48 books, and look at every text, every line, every page to make sure it's done properly. So you have to do some sampling, and we did that with these as well. Rendering them on multiple devices, Kobe and the Kindle and the iPad and all the others, just make sure they look the same in different devices. And metadata, made sure we got that. Many of the e-readers, one of the menus you'll see is author, title, and year, and that's got to be right. You have to have something to display there. So, again, make sure that metadata was done properly. And one thing we didn't do this time that I would have, and we have plans to do other conversions, is ask the vendor to specify their quality review or their workflow for quality control or quality review. Probably be a good idea for us on our end to know how they're doing it and maybe inform our decisions on how we would do our quality review. Martin showed we have a DSpace repository at Smithsonian. It has a lot of text in it, but the e-books went live there at the end of January. I'm not sure if any of you are familiar with DSpace, but it's sort of integrated with a lot of scholarly web tools. It's harvested by or it meets basic harvesting requirements from other service providers, and so it can be crawled, by Google Scholar and a lot of these things. So you can find it not just by searching our website, but by searching a lot of the others. Also, it accepts like a batch import, so we didn't have to you know, enter these things one at a time, enter metadata, upload file, enter metadata, upload file. So we had the metadata, and DSpace accepts batch imports. If you put everything in a certain format and associate a file with it, you can push it all up there at one time, which is pretty handy. It's just sort of samples of what things look like. That on the left there is the thumbnail that appears on the menu, and then on the right side is a rendition of the same page in the ebook format. Is another one. I guess this one they use because they use the publisher trademark or the logo there. They had to use the actual image, the source image files that we created. So that you know, close enough rendition of it. Now, in the future, Martin mentioned iTunes U. We'll get these things into an A Smithsonian iTunes U collection. We're not sure if we're going to integrate it into an existing collection or create its own or something like that, but that should happen within the next couple of months. And then, as I mentioned, the Smithsonian Scholarly Press publishes several series called Smithsonian Contributions to XYZ, to botany, to zoology and things. And we are going to probably be converting, like I know we are sometime this year, going to be converting those 1,000 or so volumes that are now in PDF and that the libraries converted some years ago into the ebook and EPUB formats. Those will also go into the sources that Martin mentioned, iTunes U, the Amazon bookstore, and all these other places. That's about all I got, but I would welcome your feedback, anybody, either by email or now, about how this stuff looks and if you have any suggestions for other content that could be converted. Thanks.
So just as a quick follow-on to Alvin's workflow, one of the things that we did before we started the project is we did some blog posts, we did some tweets about that this project was going to be happening, and we were trying to get feedback from the community about the types of things that they'd want. We encouraged them to search the Internet Archive, search our catalog, locate titles, and see if there's anything that they wanted that we could then do this process on. And we got some feedback on that, but again, most of our questions and problems with this were that people really wanted more contemporary things. So we had requests for Isabella Allende and things like that that are just not in our collections or doable for copyright reasons. So our question is, now that these will be up for about a month now, for the next year we're going to be evaluating the usages and downloads of these to see if this is the kind of content that might be wanted by the e-reader community in terms of Spanish language texts, or are there better or other or different things we can do to help serve that community? So again, any kind of feedback you can provide for us on that or methods to go forward would be really helpful as we go with this. There's a question in the back.
I was curious, for the feedback, do you have some kind of form that people are filling out?
And also, the issue of what countries did you pull the titles from in order to...
They came from a number of countries. We had a lot were from Spain. Some were actually U.S. publications. In terms of the feedback, basically our main feedback mechanism was comments on the blog post. So that would be... It wasn't a form so much as just a sort of a comment, send us some suggestions.
So if you went to Smithsonian Libraries and blog, you know, you'd find it and find our post on, you know, if you had anything to say.
Hi. I was wondering about the data that you use to pull all of these titles from. I'm assuming that you were searching your catalog and you just got, like, a report. Did you find any, like, it's MARC-based, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So did you find any, like, discrepancies as you were doing this, like, with the MARC cataloging and things like that? And did you end up as a separate side workflow, like, resolving any of those issues? And then also, how did you... Did she, like, hand search each title when she finally got down to the master list in WorldCat, or was there another report that you could do? I deal with MARC all the time, so I'm just really curious. And thirdly, did you recycle the MARC attached to the titles for DSpace? Did you convert it to Dublin Core, and was there any crosswalking issues with that?
Do you want me to do that?
We did not use the MARC record, the MARC data for the import into DSpace. We worked from a spreadsheet that our intern had created. There were some issues with, we sent the vendor the MARC records and they just didn't really understand or didn't know how to convert them, so we had to redo that. And as I mentioned, metadata was a big issue there. So that went back and forth a little bit, and but we ultimately sent them a spreadsheet that they had to work from.
And just the other parts of the question, we did have the intern search the catalog of our catalog. For our actual scanning workflow, what we do is we use a Z39.50 fetch technology that pulls the MARC record, converts it to a MARC XML record, and then that sort of round trips through the Internet Archive and the digital library portion of the scanning workflow.
I actually had two questions. Mm-hmm. One is about the availability of these books that you scan. Are they openly available to the public through the Smithsonian website? Mm-hmm. And are you going to do any updating of the interface to make it more visually appealing?
Mm-hmm. So the first part, yes. Our key goal of this was all free, open, available publications. So that's the main goal there. The Smithsonian platform, we're really viewing more as an archive of the content, and other interfaces will be the sales points. So really it'll be the iTunes and the Amazon and anybody else who wants to do this. We're developing a new interface to our whole overall digital library, so they'll also be available through that. But we're really sort of thinking about it more as other people will aggregate the metadata and then just point back to the repository angle.
But do you have any data about how often these books are being read or who's accessing them or any kind of analytics like that?
Have you done any stats?
Not yet, no.
Yeah. It's not been
6 weeks old or something.
And one other question. After this first 48,
what are your plans? I guess I'm assuming you're going to analyze whatever data you get back, but in the long term, what do you plan to, I mean, did you have an idea if we're going to do 500 titles or what were you guys planning on?
For the Spanish language
yes.
text, we don't have any current plans to extend this project. So it'll partly depend on the usage and other feedback we get over the next year. If we do get enough encouragement to go forward with the project, we can work with the Latino Center again to get additional funding to do another round of it. But it'll partly depend on actual desire from the user community.
It's not so much a question, just sort of like a comment and feedback. I just really think this is outstanding. I work for an NGO that promotes human rights in Cuba, and we always try to get electronic e-books. And because there's such a lack of e-books in Spanish, especially popular titles. There's a lot of banned books in Cuba that we try to get in through flash drives. So I hope you guys expand the list of books that you're doing, because this would be incredibly helpful for a lot of the projects that a lot of NGOs that work in countries like that are trying to do. So thank you.
One of the successes we've had with our Biodiversity Heritage Library project, which is a life sciences taxonomic literature project, is that we've been able to work with smaller publishers, not-for-profit publishers, and actually get permission to do more contemporary literature. So if there was a way that we could work with other NGOs that have access to materials, that's where we might be able to actually provide the funding and the resources to do the conversion and provide them through our platform and our partner platforms if someone else can actually assist with the getting the rights to those publications. And that follows on sort of Alvin's theme of, you know, in the past, librarians got books and put them on the shelves. We're now doing the same thing, but in a more interactive and proactive way in terms of actually getting the content, converting the content, and putting it on the digital shelves.
And also, will the second PowerPoint be available at the same website? Okay, so both of them will be available?
Yes, yeah, we'll do that. Okay, if there aren't any more questions, feel free to send us feedback through any type of mechanism that you can locate us, and we're happy to answer any other questions. Thanks for coming.